This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Michelle Miller's career led her from the mountains of western North Carolina down to the center of Silicon Valley. She studied business at Stanford, got a job at J.P. Morgan in Palo Alto, helping to finance the nation's throbbing tech industry. Then she gave it all up to become an author. She wrote a 12-part online serial last year, drawing on her experiences from the financial and the tech worlds. That turned into a full-length novel called The Underwriting. It's a corporate satire about location-based dating app that leads to murder. Michelle Miller's going to be reading tonight, 7 o'clock at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. First, she joins us from WCQS in Asheville. Michelle Miller, welcome to State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Where did this idea come from?
Oh, gosh. It was a lot of years in the making, to be honest. But I think what I was really trying to do was humanize these two worlds that had been so defining in my own life, Wall Street and Silicon Valley. So The Underwriting is very much, as you said, a corporate satire of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. It follows the IPO of a location-based dating app. But it follows them very much through the characters. It's really as much about the characters and their struggles with what they're doing as it is about the dynamics of Wall Street and Silicon Valley.
Those characters are it's almost hard to smash the stereotype when we think of the Wall Street shark and the techno geeks. It's really hard to get past that. You lived the life. Let me ask you this before we get to back to the novel. Sort of how much of the stereotype is just plain true?
That is a good question. The book, I really wrote the book to start with those stereotypes and take them head on. So I think for the first chapter, especially, you are just completely in the very stereotypical parts of these people. And then over the course of the novel, we really break more into their context. And I hope give readers an understandable view of why they do the things that they do. You know, a big part of this is very satirical, but it really is meant to be a compassionate satire, to the point where I think that I just wanted to explain why some of these tropes that are maybe are unlikable and unfavorable exist.
It's the Silicon Valley version of a prairie home companion. We laugh at them, but we love them.
Exactly.
Well, maybe you can read a passage and set up the scene and we'll get a better feel for the book. Would you do that for us?
Sure. So this is in the first chapter. It's my character, Tara Taylor, who is a 27-year-old investment banker at L. Cecil. So she'd been at L. Cecil since she graduated from Stanford in 2007, back when markets were good and everyone with a 3.9 GPA from a top-tier university fought to get into investment banking or management consulting. But that was 7 years ago. The financial crisis had drained the adrenaline from Wall Street, as well as the promotions and retire at 30 bonuses. Now the path that was supposed to be the right one felt static. Tara did everything right. She worked out every morning. She showed up to the office on time and never was the first to leave. She avoided gluten, limited her dairy, and didn't eat after 9 p.m. She called her parents once a week and contributed to her 401k. She exfoliated her skin, but not too often, cut her cuticles, but not too close, waxed down there, but not all the way. She read The New Yorker and supported NPR, and she always remembered to drink at least a glass of water for every glass of wine. So why did she feel so unfulfilled? What self-help book had she missed?
Oh, I love the exfoliated gluten-free NPR listeners. Thank you so much, Michelle, for that.
That was the NPR shout-out.
Well, you know, but so clearly, I mean, you had lived this life, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about your biography, living the life and graduating from Stanford and going. Had that been your aspiration all along, the idea of you know, working for J.P. Morgan at Palo Alto? Wow, that's a good job.
It was a good job, and I have nothing but good things to say about my colleagues there, so I do want to be very clear about that. But no, I got sucked in. You know, I followed this path that I think was very standard for a lot of people who, like me, had kind of come from smaller towns and gone to schools like Stanford and then graduated in 2006, which really was this world where, you know, if you were ambitious and alpha and wanted to do that thing that you felt like you were supposed to do, you were elbowing for jobs at Lehman Brothers, And meanwhile, the kids who had a little bit more balance and perspective were like kicking it in Palo Alto and working for Facebook. And what's so ironic about this whole situation is you fast forward 10 years and the guys who got the Lehman jobs lost their jobs. And the kids who worked at Facebook made $50 million. So I think there was a real justice that happened to all of us who thought that we knew how to do it.
Yeah, and the guys at Lehman Brothers lost a lot of other people's jobs as well, I might add.
It's very true.
Well, so how much of your becoming a writer had to do, and I take that you love the people and that they're all, you know, the salt of the earth, et cetera, but how much of it was the job itself that got you, or did it, or did you just get a bug for writing?
That is a really good question. I think that, you know, we all know when we're 8 what we're supposed to do. And looking back, it's incredibly clear that I always wanted to be a writer. But I think that life happens and pressures happen and reality happens. And so it's easy to get distracted. In a lot of ways, I feel incredibly fortunate that this notion that I was not on the right path hit me in my 20s at a time when I was still flexible enough, frankly, to make the change and to make the shift. It has been so such a blessing in my life to be able to pursue this this side of my personality, and really feels like a homecoming in a lot of ways to who I was as a child.
One of the boosts along the way was a writing instructor that you talked with who gave you some pretty good guidance about using your experience as the grist for your novels. Tell us about that.
Oh, that's so I took a class in business school. So I went to Stanford undergrad and then I went back for my MBA in 2009, graduating in 2011. And in my second year, I was just really in the midst of this, what do I do with my life? You know, very privileged existential crisis. But I took a creative writing class as just an outlet, which was a fiction writing seminar with a bunch of freshmen who thought I was so lame because all my stories were about business and theirs were about vampires.
But so wait, what's the difference? What's the difference, he said sardonically?
So I learned so much from them. But in the meantime, I went to a talk by Neil Baer, who was the creator of ER. And I went up to him afterwards and I was like, I just feel like I've completely screwed up. I should have gone to get my MFA, not my MBA. What have I done? And he said, you know what? You're going to know within 2 minutes whether or not you can write. The difference is whether you have something to write about. And he said, you know, everyone before ER said that medicine was way too difficult for anyone to understand because it was just so complicated. And it wasn't complicated for me because he had been to medical school. And so he got the lingo. And it was a time when, you know, Occupy was in full force, and I was feeling like I was kind of the target of it by being at this business school. And I got that, and I totally understood, and I sympathized with the Occupy Wall Street, and I'm actually incredibly supportive of it. But I did want to, but I had this moment of like, could you do with investment banking what Neil Baer did for ER? And could you actually get in and be able to explain it and humanize it in a way that was not just this polarizing black and white nonfiction portrayal? And you have to do that through fiction, right? That is where fiction can be so powerful to me, is in creating empathy and humanizing these worlds that otherwise can be so vicious and polarizing in the nonfiction media.
And you do that in your debut novel, The Underwriting, but also, so we get the characterizations, we begin to see these worlds, Silicon Valley, the tech world, the finance world that helps support it, but it's a murder mystery as well. Had that been something you always wanted to do? And was that, how difficult or how challenging was that to create in this book once you got past the stuff you know all about?
Oh, that's yes. So a girl dies. spoiler alert. But yeah, so I think that was a really important part of this world. You know, I think that the book is about this location-based dating app, and something that was very prescient and very present in my mind was the safety concerns around these apps that we give so much information to. And we give it so flippantly. I do too. Like, there are 30 apps on my phone right now that are all tracing my location. And I did have this moment in Silicon Valley. I was at the office of what has now become an incredibly ubiquitous company. And there was this big screen where they were, where they had little dots with all the users and where they were on a map, and they could see it, and they thought it was so cool. They had it prominently displayed. And my immediate thought was, oh my God, they have all of our location information from where we've been, which is totally fine if they're good, safety conscious people. But it's really scary when you think about the possibility of someone hacking in and getting that information. And so the murder mystery that happens is very much about what happens when that information gets leaked into the wrong hands.
Can I get you to read for us again?
Sure. So this is from the point of view of my character, Juan, who's an engineer at Hook, who's just made a scary discovery about Kelly Jacobson, who is the girl who's died. So he got up to go, then turned back to look at the date of her single meetup this year, March 6th. He stopped, feeling his palms start to sweat. When had she died? Juan held his breath and Googled her name. He clicked on the Wikipedia article and blinked to make sure he was reading it correctly. Time of death recorded is 4:47 a.m., March 6, 2014. Juan clicked open the entry in the database. The time of meeting with the other user was 2:18 a.m. He clicked the map and scrolled into 558 Mayfield Avenue, Xanadu residence, Stanford University. Despite all his attempts not to pay attention to the stories over the past weeks, he knew Kelly's friends had dropped her off alone at 1 a.m. The news had never said anything about her being with someone else afterward. He clicked the profile on the other user, bracing himself, but the profile wouldn't load. He refreshed, nothing. Finally, a box popped up with the words, "Path Corrupted." Kelly Jacobson wasn't alone when she died, but who had she been with, and who did he have to tell?
That's Michelle Miller. She's reading from her book, The Underwriting. She's going to be at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville tonight at 7, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow at 7, and with me on the state of things. When you got to the mystery part, you know, it's interesting because any of us who have had these kinds of thoughts, like what if, you know, this app is following me, that's the beginnings of a mystery. Does it get complicated? Do you have to sort of keep track of your own plot? And I wonder how hard that is to once you begin to craft the mystery. You've got the outlines, and then you start running into the details. It can be challenging, can it?
Oh, it's very challenging. It's where it's so helpful to have an editor. And my editor at Putnam has just been extraordinary because it is, you sort of have all of the background and you have all the details. And it's so much that craft of how much do you tell and how much do you trust readers to figure out. And that was it's a pure craft thing, and it's something I learned a lot about through this. But what I like about, you know, the way that this is set up is it also creates a real dilemma for this character, Juan, whose point of view that just came from, because her death and this information that he finds out will ruin the deal that's going to make him a lot of money. And he's a really sympathetic character. He didn't come from anything. He's one of these characters in Silicon Valley who really has lived the American dream in the sense that his company is gonna IPO and he's gonna make a lot of money, and all of a sudden this snag comes. And so watching that personal struggle with what to do is where the other drama comes in.
And that is the humanizing part, and where it probably helps a lot to actually know these individuals as human beings and not as stereotypes that come across as in some of the films we've seen and some of the other books. So before the novel, now you did a 12-part online serial, one installment a week. It was free, I think, for the first 24 hours, right? And then cost a small fee. This is really kind of the future of publishing, isn't it? And how did it work out for you?
I hope so. It worked out great for me. It was a really fun process. I am obsessed with serial as a form. You know, it's how Dickens published. It's how Henry James published. Even Bonfire of the Vanities was initially a serial in the back of Rolling Stone magazine. So I just got really hooked on what had happened to that form and what that form would look like if you applied it in a digital age, and how that might attract new readers. I think there's something about the serial that's so appropriate for the modern reader because it does give you these short, satisfying chunks that fit into our busy lives, but also allows this ongoing relationship with a character, which I think television especially has really proven that we want in our content. And so, so I just sort of started with that thesis of what would Dickens do if he were living today and The Tale of Two Cities wasn't London and Paris, but was San Francisco and New York. And so I left my job in 2013 and I raised money and built this website. And it was very elaborate. We had DJ playlists and brand sponsors and artwork and photography, and tried to create a real world around the content. And like you said, released an episode every week that was free for 24 hours on the browser or could be downloaded as a text or an audio file.
That particular business model and the way you went around about the fundraising, had you seen models like that before, or did you create that of whole cloth?
No, I guess it came from my head.
Another fiction really... that you've perpetrated on the American public.
Well, you know, it was interesting. For, I mean, I am so interested in how you create experiences that represent a world and represent an ethos. And I think as much as this book is a murder mystery and as much as it is a satire, it's really about the millennial generation and I think what the millennial ethos is all about, which to me, a keystone of that is empathy, but another keystone of that is doing things differently. And so it felt to me like this was how the story needed to be told, and at least needed to start. The idea was always, the hope was always to get a traditional publishing contract out of it, which has worked out so beautifully for me, because I do think it's a great way to seed and test content, you know, from the business perspective. But artistically, it was really about creating from start to finish an expression of the millennial world.
Did you have part 12 written before you released part one?
I did. I finished everything in January. We started releasing in March, but I had everything finished and edited. I think editing is such an important process. You know, there's self-publishing and there's traditional publishing, and then there's this big space in between, which is writing something, but then having it edited in a way that's really brings out the best of it. And that was very important to me. I'm way too much of a control freak to write as I go.
Well, so, and you talk about the millennial experience. Will it all be online at some point? I mean, are we seeing the end of tangible media, as we used to say?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so at all. I actually think that, you know, to me, Serial is to novel as photography is to painting. They are two totally different mediums. They're different forms of art. And you can have an object, like the story, that is, you know, first you do it as a photograph, and then you do it as a painting. And now I'm actually, we're doing the television for The Underwriting right now, so I'm working on the script. And so all of those are very different forms, and it's really fun as an artist to play in those different mediums because you can just do such different things. And I think that, you know, in terms of the reader and the consumer, consumers want choice, and they want to be able to say, I want to read it this way or I want to read it that way. But there will always be people that love books, and there will always be people who wait for the books in the same way that there are people who wait for all the seasons of House of Cards to come out so that they can binge watch. And so I think it's important to have all of them.
Tell us about the TV series. It's in production, right? You're waiting for a distributor, as I understand it, but you're in production.
Yeah, so
we just
announced the deal with Endemol Shine, mm-hmm. which is a production company in LA who I'm just tickled to be working with. They, I think, really, really understand what we're trying to do. So I'll be writing and executive producing that, which is an exciting, daunting task.
Is it entirely different if you're writing for the screen than what you do for print?
Oh, well, it's just so much more efficient, you know? Like you take something, like I was just writing Nick Winthrop is one of my characters in The Underwriting, and, you know, what I can do in a novel in four paragraphs, you have, you know, his characterization, for example, there's four paragraphs that describes who he is. And in the script, instead of describing him, you just have his bookshelf behind him in the shot, right? And you have all the books on the shelf that then tell you who he is. And so that kind of nuance is really tight and efficient, but it also forces, I think, me as a writer to just know these characters on an even deeper level.
And as the story came to you, did you have all these platforms in mind? Did you see it online and in print and on TV, or kind of all at
you
once?
Know, I initially thought of it as a TV series you could read. I'm so enamored of TV right now and what it is doing in terms of drawing compassion for characters. And you know, why do we like Tony Soprano? Why do we care about him? He's a terrible human being, right? And yet you feel for him and you care about him. And that to me is just so interesting artistically, but also as a consumer and as a human being, and also just societally. Why are we wanting that? Why are we craving that right now as a population so much? So I think that television has really inspired a lot of my thinking in terms of writing, which was easy to do in the serial. In the novel, I think it still keeps that same pace and that same characterization.
That's Michelle Miller. She's the author of the new novel, Underwriting. You can hear her read from her book tonight, 7 o'clock at Malaprops in Asheville. Tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Quail Ridge in Raleigh. If you missed that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Michelle, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Just ahead, a preview of tonight's Back Porch Music Concert with Australian singer-songwriter Darren Hanlon. Stay tuned.